Welcome to Rights for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Each week on The Convo Couch, I'll be chatting to a wide range of women writers, focusing on the heart, craft, and business of writing, along with a new release feature author each month. You can listen to the episodes on any of the major podcasting platforms or directly from the Rights for Women website, where you'll also find the transcript of each chat and the extensive Rights for Women backlist. On a personal writing note, my current release is All We Dream. If you'd like to know more about it or any of my books, you can check out my website at pamelacook.com.au for more information. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Now, let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest. Campion is my guest today on Rights for Women, and it's a real pleasure to have Esther back on the podcast. We had Esther with her first book, and it's great to have her back now with book number three. Esther is actually from Cork in Ireland originally and currently lives in northwestern Tasmania. Her debut novel, Leaving Ocean Road, was published in July by Hachette, Australia, and it's a story set across the landscapes of Greece, Ireland, and small-town coastal Australia. It follows the life of Ellen O'Shea as she struggles to deal with her husband's death and an unexpected visitor from her past. Following Leaving Ocean Road, Esther published the sequel, which was The House of Second Chances, in 2019, and her new release, which is actually out this week, is A Week to Remember. It's a standalone, but it does feature some of the characters that we've grown to know and love in Esther's previous two books, as well as some brand new ones. Esther and her family live in Tassie with an overindulged chocolate Labrador and two horses, which Esther firmly believes are living proof that dreams really do come true. Esther, it's so good to have you on the podcast again. Welcome to Rights for Women.
I'm absolutely delighted and honoured to be here with you, Pam. It's great.
Lovely to see you too. We had a little bit of trouble getting everything connected, but we did connect finally, so that's great. Before we start with launching into talking about your book, and I deliberately didn't give a blurb or anything for the new book because I'm going to ask you to do that for us. I did recently see a photo of you on Instagram where you were jetty jumping, and it really intrigued me. And I'm imagining it would be quite chilly jumping off a jetty down there in Tasmania. But can you tell us a little bit about that pastime?
Well, I've been jetty jumping since I moved to Australia about 13 years ago now. I lived, as you know, in Port Lincoln in South Australia, and it was a great pastime there. And of course, I've been a swimmer all my life, and, you know, we would do sea swimming, you know, tank swimmers. But in the summers, we loved swimming together in the sea. My family would go on, you know, holidays by the seaside and all that. As teenagers, we used to cycle to the beaches and stuff. So when I came to Australia and I saw these people doing this jetty jumping, I thought, my word, this is for me. So yes, so we've got in Tassie now, the water is absolutely fabulous. It's like Mediterranean. Okay. I tell you, I was in again last night, now not jetty jumping, but just a dip, and it's surprisingly warm. And it's probably not a good thing, the global warming and everything, but I mean, I must say I'm taking advantage of it. But I do love the old jetty jump, like.
Oh, that's great. And you had some really great pics on Instagram. I loved it.
That's good. It's a bit mad, like, but you know, sometimes you've got to do a bit of something a bit mad, don't you?
Absolutely. I love it. I think it's fantastic. Well, to begin with, Esther, before we get into Week to Remember, could you tell us just a little bit about just your writing history and your publishing journey, how you got to be where you are today?
I will, of course. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't writing anything until I moved to Australia. Well, no, I tell a lie. I was living in Norway and I tried a correspondence course in creative writing because I had at the time firmly in my mind that writing was something that you didn't just sit down and do. You had to go to sort of a class and a course and that sort of thing, which of course is completely untrue. I've learned since. But I didn't like the correspondence course because, you know, there's no interaction. There was no cup of tea. It was boring as all hell. So anyway, I came to Australia and then I thought, right, we're thinking, what will I do with myself now? I'm getting the kids settled into kindy and schools and that. And I thought, well, I want to put a creative writing course. I was wanting to do that. Maybe there's one in the TAFE, with TAFE in Port Lincoln. But unfortunately, the course wasn't still running. It had run years before. But out of that course, a lovely writing group called Air Writers had formed. So I rang them up to find out, you know, where would I do this kind of course? And they said to me, oh, no, there's nothing. But look, come and join us. So I didn't want to be rude, but I said, look, I'm not a writer at all, you know, but I kind of was a bit fascinated. And the lady on the phone was saying, oh, I'm writing a novel and, oh, it's great fun. And I thought, holy living God, like I can hardly write my own name. But they said, bring something to the meeting. And all I had was an email I had sent to some friends once I'd got to, you know, within the first week of arriving in Australia. And I was really telling them about the madness of the transition from, you know, -9 in Norway to 36 the weekend I arrived in Australia. So, and a few other incidents. And I was last to read at that meeting. And you know what writers' groups are like. But anyway, they went around the room and you had the award-winning short storytellers and you writers and you had the poets, the published poets and the people that were, you know, noveling away and getting very close to publication. And I read this email anyway at the end, and the president of the club, like the group, she nudged me and she said, you can stay. And I thought, great, I'll be making the tea. But they were the nicest group of people to me. And just, I kept going once a fortnight meeting. You know, they put up a challenge, write a poem. I'd write a poem, write a short story, try to write a short story. They're very hard to write. I take my hat off to anybody who can write them. And then they had these retreats. For week-long retreats outside, a place outside Port Lincoln. And I was so envious of those people. But of course, I could never go on a retreat, A, because I wasn't writing a novel. It was only for novelists. And B, because my children obviously needed to be minded. But my lovely husband said to me, why don't you go for a couple of nights? And I'd hold the fort, like, you'd be fine. And I thought, oh, isn't that lovely? And I thought, well, there's only one problem, I'm not writing a novel. So I started throwing down an idea had come to me in Norway, and I started writing for all my lists to save myself. And I was accepted on, and I got a place on the retreat, and I went with 11 pages, and I came home, or no, by the end of the first day, I had about 22. And I thought,
oh, wow.
Right. But it was the peace. And you know, that silent sort of time in a writing retreat where, you know, it's just you and the page, but you know, people doing the same thing behind you in the company and talking over things at night. And I just loved, I got hooked. And you know, I'm sure that first novel wasn't much good, like, but I started putting it out to publishers, getting my rejections. And I think somebody recently I heard on a webinar or something talking about your apprenticeship. And I thought, wasn't that a lovely idea? You might agree with me, Pam. It can take years.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's something you never stop learning about, isn't it?
No, you don't. You don't. Because every book then is a blank canvas. So, you know, I'm writing another one now and I'm terrified. Do you know, there's no guarantees, like, just because you have three published novels, that, you know, you're on to the next one. But you keep going. If you love it, you keep going.
Absolutely. You know? And was that book that you started there at that retreat, was that Leaving Ocean Road?
No, that was my next one. I sent that one now to about, I think I might have got about 10 or 12 rejections, but I got a beautiful rejection from, do you remember the book, P.S. I Love You?
Yes.
By Cecilia Hearn.
Yes.
Well, I brazenly sent that first novel to her agent in Dublin. Because really? I kind of didn't know where I was. I thought, oh, well, I'm only off the boat here now. Like, I'll send back home.
Yeah.
And she gave me the most beautiful rejection. She said, this isn't for me, but it's good women's fiction and keep writing. Good luck. Like, I have that email printed out and nearly framed. I have it in a notebook, stuck in a notebook. And you know, you can take it two ways. You can kind of go, oh, well, you know, it's not good enough. Or you can say, well, who am I to argue with Marianne Gunn O'Connor? So that was kind of the attitude I took. And I started another one then, because I suppose I was just into it. I just thought, oh, sure. You know, another idea came to me, wrote Leaving Ocean Road. And what I did, I mean, there are people listening now, like I listen to your podcast, and they are listening and hoping to glean the kind of helpful tips and tricks and things. But I tell everybody who wants to know, my sort of pivotal moment really was my mother had given me money and, you know, made me swear I'd spend it within the year she'd given it to me on writing. And I got to the end of the year, the beginning of December, I went to a self-publishing workshop. I found out it wasn't for me at all, because I couldn't even log on to the flipping Twitter thing they wanted us to be on. And I was hopeless, like really hopeless. And they got to the point, like the two facilitators in the workshop, where they were avoiding me.
Oh, you know, no.
I think I was that helpless. So anyway, I just thought to myself, you know, I might as well throw in the towel, like nothing's going to work for me. But that evening, there was a man, Pierre gave a bit of a talk, and we had dinner with him afterwards, John Sheehan, he's a Tasmanian. And he mentioned a manuscript assessor that he'd heard of, or that he'd heard speaking at the Festival of Golden Words in Beaconsfield in Tassie that the year before or whatever. And it was Irina Dunn. And I contacted her, and she's a manuscript assessor. And I think she'd been head of one of the writing centres in one of the states.
Yeah, she used to be involved with Varuna, I think, and also Writing New South Wales,
Yeah, and that was the bit that it was money well spent. It was a lot of money. She wasn't cheap. But I just got to the point where I thought, if I don't give this over to somebody in the know, and I needed somebody to tell me whether this was good enough or not, because I was losing faith. And she came back to me. She said, yeah, it is good enough. Cut 10,000 words out of it and it'll be grand. So I did that. And then I said, well, what do I do now? And she said, oh, you know, for another load of money, like I'll send it out to a few people I know. And she did that. Okay. And I sort of invested myself and my husband, you know, it was a decision. Are we going to invest in this? And he said, yeah, you've come this far now. Keep going. That's what I did. And luckily it landed on the desk of the lovely Rebecca Saunders in Hachette. And through a bit of a roundabout thing, but it did. And that was, you know, he got the phone call and that was the break, the lucky break.
And I love that idea of perseverance, Esther, and backing yourself, you know, like believing in what you've got and just trying another avenue, you know, when one doesn't work, try something else.
Yes. And, you know, as well as anybody with your own books, it's a fairly lonely road, like, you know, and it's, I don't know about anybody, I can only speak for myself, but like the self-doubt and the imposter syndrome, and you know, that's all weighs fairly heavy. Like, so I suppose part of what we do is trying to ignore the inner critic and just keep going.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Let's get on to talking about the new book, A Week to Remember. I've been reading it. It's lovely, and it's just your beautiful sort of cozy style that draws the reader in. But can you tell us what it's about? Give us the blurb.
Yeah, I'll give you the blurb. I remember it. Well, it is set, I suppose, mostly in West Cork, in the southwest of Ireland, and also in the northwest of Tasmania, where I'm currently living. But there's a newly renovated guest house called Lizzie O's, and it's taking in its first guest for a week in the Irish winter that none of them will forget. So I, as usual, I've got a bit of an ensemble of characters, sort of main characters and supporting characters in the community. And I've got a couple, Mick and Aisling Fitzgerald, who are going to celebrate a wedding anniversary. They've been gifted by their family. They're Irish, but they're living in Tasmania. And they go along. And then his mother comes to Tassie to look after the children and kind of house sit. And so her storyline develops sort of alongside that of her daughter-in-law and son. So then I have a dentist, Declan, who is probably the grumpiest. Well, Layla described him as grouchy, actually. She read an early copy. And she said, I love your grouchy characters. But I was a bit challenged by writing them because, you know, it's quite easy for me to write nice people.
No, you did a great job of making Declan grouchy, I thought.
Thank you. Yes. So he's there and he's had a marriage breakup and his practice manager thinks it's a good idea if he sort of, you know, has a bit of a holiday, probably trying to get rid of him for a week. Yeah. And he goes down there, but he has roots down there, which he has probably forgotten. And then who else do I have? Oh, I have Katie Daly. She's a very important character. She's been away from the village for about 35 years after a traumatic time. And she's returning home because her sister begs her to mind the mother, the aging mother. And because the sisters, after meeting somebody, she's got the opportunity to go to Spain for a week. So Katie sort of begrudgingly agrees to return to look after the mother and has to face this past that she's run away from in the first place. And who else have I then?
Oh, and Mia.
Mia Montgomery. She's there and she hasn't told her husband she's there. So she slips away for a bit of an escape of her own to sort a few things out about her marriage and without telling Harry. Mm.
So you sort of put the characters into this almost like a pressure cooker, isn't it? You know, they're all thrown together, these people that don't know each other. Some of them, like Aisling and Mick, have their own problems going on, you know, without even dealing with the other characters who are there. But then, of course, well, they all have their own issues. And then putting them all together, it almost like accentuates, you know, their own conflicts, doesn't it? But it also allows them to play off each other and to share things and learn from each other in this beautiful setting of this guest house that you've created. And I could really visualize, you know, it's newly decorated because it's just been fixed up and renovated. And I love the way that you sort of describe all that. But the characters are really almost forced together, aren't they, in this setting, which then triggers off a whole lot of other things happening for them.
They are, definitely, Pam. And the thing about it is, like, when they get there first, they're not there to make friends, really, you know, and to kind of have the partying of a night, you know. But, of course, the way it's set up is there's a conservatory, which is the dining area, and it's got the the dining table. So that's where they have to sit of an evening to have dinner because dinner is prepared by the lovely Ellen and Jerry. So I suppose they're all holding back and trying to sort out their own stuff. But inevitably there are connections made between the different characters around the table.
Yeah. It's very relatable, I think, because I think we've all been in that situation. It could be a weekend away at a guest house, like you say, or a motel type setup, or it could just be a restaurant, you know, where you walk in and there's only the communal table left. And sometimes you just don't want to have to talk to people. And then you're forced to sit down and be sociable and be friendly. And you find that it does, you know, your barriers do generally break down. So it's interesting to watch the way the barriers break down for these characters to a greater or lesser extent as well. But how did you manage, Esther? You have got quite a lot of characters and storylines going on in the writing of this book. How did you sort of manage that? Do you just start with one character and go and see what happens and then introduce the others? How do you do that structurally?
Yes, that's exactly how I do it. I mean, I'm very much a pantser, Pam, you know, with the writing by the seat of the pants sort of technique. I actually started that book with Mia Montgomery, even though I think the book opens with Aisling on the beach having a walk with their friend, in Tassie, still in Tassie. I started with Mia, and then I suppose, like, as it went on, I just moved kind of scenes and people around and stuff like that. But the editing was brilliant from Hachette, the publishers. You know, I had fabulous editing help. But of course, you've got to have a bit of a thick skin because, you know. You put in the book and then this, in my case, I mean, I remember going to a writing retreat and my friends were saying, you know, what are you writing, Esther? And of course I was saying, well, you know, I've got this jumble of characters you know, and they were saying, but that's okay, like that you always have a jumble of characters, you know. And I was like, well, but this is a real jumble. But I think I ended up killing a couple of darlings because there was a lot going on. But to be fair, I like that, you know, in my imagination. I like the kind of the buzz and the, you know, who's, you know, I love the supporting characters. Like there's a character there, you know, different, these different characters, like a couple of teenage girls belong to the neighbour up the road in Tassie, you know, these people, they're all part of it for me.
And it's all world building, isn't it?
Almost. It is.
Yeah.
It is. But the editors were very much like, come on, Esther, there's a limit to what the reader can take, you know, just, but I suppose just you're better off, you know, having more and being able to cut back in the rewrite than the adding on. You know, I suppose that's, you know, practically.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing to.
Sort of reminds me of like a tapestry, you know, and you have your big main pieces, which you have your characters, and then you've got all these little smaller interconnecting pieces, you know, but it's all part of one whole. I enjoyed that about the book.
That's really good because that's what I loved writing. I love writing the kind of community that we ended up with, like, you know, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, it's set in, as you say, both Tasmania and Western Cork. And we've been to that particular setting in Cork before because it's the guest house that Ellen and Jerry did up, isn't it?
Exactly right. Yes, Ellen and Jerry got Ellen's friend Colette Barry, an interior designer, and Ellen's brother Aidan O'Shea to renovate the house. So it's the O'Shea family home, which is now called Lizzie O's, in memory of the grandmother. So this is where the action is set.
Yeah. And do you love going back into that setting each time? You know, when even though this is a standalone book, you know, you are going back to that setting and revisiting some familiar characters. Is it sort of like, you know, meeting up with old friends again for you?
But it is. And like, you know, last year when COVID hit, like I was really grateful that I had this imaginary kind of story going on, you know, because I think it's important as a writer to kind of fall in love with your characters and, you know, really invest. And well, I suppose we do that as right. But I kind of described it, COVID was a weird for everybody. And I felt that some people were busting a gut, like the essential workers, and they were doing over and above. And then you had other people that didn't know what to do with themselves. And then you had people that were like doubling up at home, working from home and kids and but I felt with the writing I felt very fortunate because it was a bit business as usual. I could keep on with the writing. Well, it would have been the rewriting, I suppose, at that stage of the book, but it was a great comfort. And I kind of felt it was like, you know when you unzip a tent and you get into the tent and then you zip it back up behind you and you're in this kind of a bit of a cocoon. So I loved that. You know, and the whole, I mean, somebody asked me recently if I get home very often, and I actually don't. I'd love to get home more often. Of course, nobody's going anywhere at the moment, but that it's very important to me, to tap into these places and revisit them, even in terms of imagination. Yeah,
and that setting, Esther, in Ireland, where the book is largely set, is that where you come from yourself, or a place that you're very familiar with? I'm guessing so.
No. You know, I don't come from there, and I'd say they'll absolutely murder me if they find out. You know, I'm writing about their place, like, because I tell you how exactly I fell in love with that place when I was in university. I'm from Cork City,
right?
And it's very important when you're in Ireland to kind of say you're from the city because you'd be very proud to be from the city. Do you know?
Okay.
But anyway. Definitely not. I don't know whether it's a university thing or an Irish thing, but anyway. So I was in uni, and this friend of mine, her parents had a caravan in West Cork, in this place, Crookhaven, that I write about. And she invited me down for a weekend. Now, it was bedlam in the caravan because there was about five of them kids. She was the eldest. So they were all going down from her, and we were only probably first or second year uni students. And the parents in the caravan, big long thing. We call it a mobile home
okay.
in Ireland, yeah. but it doesn't go anywhere because it's on a load of bricks and it stays there. But anyway, that's another story. So I went there and I thought it was the best crack ever. Like, there's only myself and my sister and my family. It's this big family and the caravan. It was like all a bit hilarious for me. And I thought it was brilliant. And I'd say I was never so quiet in all my life because there was so many talking and yeah. so much going on. I loved it. So then the parents were kind enough. When myself and my now husband had our first child, they said to us one time, would you go down to Crookhaven and take the caravan for a week or whatever? Or,
yeah.
And they renovated a house in the town, in the village. So, of course, we happily went down with our baby and had a beautiful, beautiful time. And every time I go back home, I take a trip down there. I've introduced my sister, my mother, my nephew to the place, and my own children. And we might just go down and, you know, sit down on the pier on a nice day, buy a sandwich, eat the sandwiches, look out to sea, might have a dip. Of course, I'd have yep. to have a dip myself yep. and my sister. But yes, I absolutely love the place. Very special to me.
Yeah.
Love about it.
Well, it comes through, I think, that love of the place and in the setting and in the way you write. And I think you've got a little piece you're going to read for us, Esther, of just some part of the guest house or the setting there, because I wanted everybody to be able to hear you reading this in your lovely accent, because your Irish look definitely comes through in the writing. It's beautiful.
Okay, so I'm actually reading from chapter 6. I'm trying not to give anything away.
Yeah.
This is just a little piece about Katie Daly, one of the main characters. Miss Daly. Katie opened her eyes and dragged herself up straight and out of her slumber in the back seat of the car, where she must have nodded off soon after she'd been picked up at Cork Airport. With her eyes adjusting to the weak afternoon sunlight, she took in the farmhouse with the green door and mused over the old myth as to what secrets lay beyond. Her spine tingled. The house didn't need to have secrets. She had enough of her own. As her driver got out, a woman appeared in the doorway, wrapping a loose-fitting sweater around her, holding it together with one hand while giving a friendly wave with the other. If she thought this was cold, Katie thought, she should try one of their winters in the States. The smell hit her the moment the driver opened the door, a salty mix of freshness and the spoils washed up from the ocean. Her head spun at the assault on her senses. Between the naked branches of the tree-lined garden, she glimpsed the slate-grey sea. Tears smarted at the corners of her eyes, unexpected tears. Perhaps this was a mistake, coming here after all these years, almost unravelling within the first 30 seconds. No, she was stronger than that. Planting her feet on the driveway, she took a deep breath and vowed to get through this week unscathed by memories from a lifetime ago. You've got the best room of all, the friendly woman in wool was telling her. I'm Ellen. Yes, they corresponded by email. As they shook hands, the woman touched Katie's elbow. You must be exhausted, she said, looking at her as if she were about to fall down. Come on and I'll show you where you are. Katie smiled inwardly. She knew exactly where she was, but Ellen O'Shea didn't need to know. She let her lead the way, acknowledging a certain intrigue as to what had become of the old O'Shea family home.
Thank you, Esther. That was a really great piece to select too. And I found Katie a really poignant character, actually. She's in this situation where she's in a place she really doesn't want to be, but she's got this family obligation. And did you, when you were writing, you know, we did say there's a lot of characters here for you to write and develop. Did you have any that you were sort of drawn to more than others and any that were difficult for you to develop the way that you wanted to?
Well, Katie would be a case in point, definitely, because I felt that, you know, some themes around her character mm-hmm. development as I got to know her and sort of worked out what had happened to her, why she had been away for so long. Challenging, but also quite interesting to explore. So without giving in any spoilers away, I suppose, you know, I was reflecting on something that had happened to Katie in the 80s. And, you know, also within that, it was things that were happening in Ireland at the time to do with cultural mores and norms and related to the Catholic Church and the sort of stranglehold that that had over people and the way we sort of treated women and girls. So that was important to me to grapple with. That was sort of, and that actually started me when I began the book. I felt I had read around these issues and, you know, took that very seriously on the journey through the book, because I like to write humor. I like to write funny things and light sort of, you know, scenes and things. But definitely I find myself drawn to this time around, definitely, and previous books as well, that the kind of heavier, somebody said to me, the dark with the light.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what life's about, really. You know, it's not all sweetness and light.
I think it helps the readers relate to the characters too, and like you say, having those secrets or something in the past that, you know, you don't reveal up front, you've got to keep reading to find out what it is that they're keeping secret, what it is that they're hiding or feeling uncomfortable about. And I think that's part of drawing the reader in too, isn't it?
Definitely.
Declan, you mentioned him before as you know, maybe not such a nice character. He's a little bit sleazy, isn't he, at times? A little bit of a, you know, likes to ogle the women and things. How did you go writing him? Because he does come across as a really interesting character.
Well, I'm so glad you say that, because he appeared in the previous novel, In the House of Second Chances, and he was one of the ones that one of the editors recommended I cut. And, you know, and I thought, I'm just going to see what I can do with him, really, because he's an awful idiot in the beginning, you know. He is misogynistic and he's a desperate lifestyle, you know, ordering Uber Eats and drinking too much red wine. Mm. And, you know, as you say, a bit of a sleaze. So there's a heart in there, you know, it's not all bad. So I definitely love writing him. And in particular, you know, he's one of these people who shows up there and, you know, can't be bothered with. He's not into the deep and meaningful or anything like that. That's not what he went there for. But he does strike up a bit of a connection with Mick, the guy who comes from Tasmania. I loved writing that relationship.
Yeah, and how that friendship,
How between two men, I don't think I had written that before. Or as in depth anyway.
Did you feel that you were sort of exploring different sorts of issues or going deeper into some issues in this novel, Esther, than you have in your previous ones?
I think probably the particular issues that I chose challenged me more, for sure. And I feel there's a braveness required, a kind of a courage required when you're writing about these issues, because, you know, you're talking about, you know, the relatability of books and characters. But I think there then is a responsibility to deal with issues in a certain way as well, in a kind of a careful way, I suppose. I just enjoyed the opportunity of writing about things close to my heart. Yeah, just things that are important to me.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the privileges of writing. Well, I mean, I only write fiction, but, you know, just teasing out some of those issues and how painful they can be for people, but also the, you know, the themes around reconciliation and in particular, forgiveness. And human kindness, these sorts of, you know, traits that I suppose somewhere we all have deep down.
Yes. And some people you have to dig a bit deeper to find them, but they're there. Yeah.
Yeah, some people are them. Like,
yeah. Well, I think you do a lovely job of that. I wanted to ask you, you have a cover quote from Kathy Kelly, who is one of the most popular women's fiction authors, probably going around, has been for some time. And your stories have been likened to those of Maeve Binchy and Monica McInerney. How do you feel about those sorts of comparisons?
A bit terrified, to be quite honest. I mean, you know, like for me, I don't think I read a Monica McInerney until I'd moved to Australia. But certainly, and I love Monica McInerney's books, in particular, The House of Memories. Oh, I just love that book. But anyway, Maeve Binchy would have been a household name, of course, in Ireland. I remember my mother having a copy of Light a Penny Candle, which came out in 1982, when I would have been in my teens. So she was very much like a larger-than-life character in Ireland. So, you know, to be in my 40s and now my 50s, and to be, for my writing to be compared to hers, I just find that, you know, phenomenal. I mean, I absolutely will say, you know, there will never be another Maeve Binchy, but to come anywhere close for readers in terms of the enjoyment they get out of the books is just, for me, it's absolutely amazing.
It must be amazing. It must be a huge honour to be in that, you know, put into that genre, I guess, into that box with those authors who you've read and loved. And a great way for you, I guess, to sort of see where your books fit too in terms of readership, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And I mean, you know, I was talking earlier on about, you know, the blank canvas and you know, being terrified every time you start a new book. But, you know, kind of beside that is that kind of encouragement, you know, and that the honour of being mentioned in the same sentence as these people, and the encouragement that you can take from that. I mean, I just was thinking of Kathy Kelly. You mentioned Kathy Kelly earlier, and I just, you know, I flicked her an email this morning just to say thanks a million, you're staying with my books, you know, and she's on the cover of this one again. Her lovely, are just a phenomenal writer. And her 21st book is coming out in April.
Wow.
And this is my third.
Yeah.
And I just think, wow, like, you know, just feel very, like, unworthy.
Just keep going, keep going. You've only got, what, 18 more to go.
bit of catching up to do, definitely.
Oh, no, but it's great. As you say, it's sort of inspiration, isn't it, for us to keep going.
I think you just have to keep going. I mean, like, you know, you can look at it two ways. Is it inspiration or is it desperate pressure altogether? But yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely.
Now let's go with the inspiration, I think.
Definitely.
So just before we start wrapping up, what have been for you the best things about having your books published? And what have been some of the challenges, if any, that you've found in being a published author?
Well, the best thing ever about being a published author is the connections to people generally, but in particular, people that, like, I would have been close to, you know, maybe when I was in my teens and my 20s and that have kind of, you know, we've got this thing now, like, to kind of connect us. Not that we ever needed that, really, but I just love that. I love the... And even people I don't know, just, you know, people say nice things about you. Like, I mean, I think the world needs, you know, the kind of that kind of encouragement that we give each other, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's, and yeah, that's the nicest thing, is connecting with people. It's absolutely above everything.
Yeah.
You know, the conversation we're having now, I mean, you and I met at Romance Writers of Australia conference.
We did.
A few years ago,
yeah.
You know. And it's those sort of kind of moments where you kind of, like, a touch point where you meet somebody that you connect with, you kind of like, a bit like-minded, you're doing a similar thing.
Yeah.
And then, but this is giving us an opportunity to reconnect, which is lovely.
That's right. Yeah.
So any particular challenges of being a published author? I think definitely the kind of the pressure to produce another book or another, you know. But I think, as you said, you know, and, you know, I was saying earlier, a lot of that is in your own head. I think, you know, the most important thing about writing is to just sit down and do it, really, like, and get over yourself, you know.
For sure, yeah. And you said you are working on another book at the moment?
I am. I'm fairly the early stages. I'm, you know, and this is the other thing. I mean, comparing yourself to other people. I mean, I could be, you know, sitting here and say, oh, well, you know, it's terrible. I should have another one kind of drafted by now or whatever. But I mean, that just, you know, it doesn't help you. It doesn't help me anyway. So
yeah.
I am tipping away as ever. I am contracted for another book. I'm very happy. Well, I have two book deals so far, and this fourth novel, it's in the works, it's in the pipeline.
Brilliant. That's exciting.
I'm not saying too much about it, probably because I don't actually know too much about it yet.
Early days, yeah, for sure. Well, I've really enjoyed reading A Week to Remember, and I know that people who have loved your earlier books are going to love it. And anybody who loves just a lovely, warm, cozy read with great characters, interesting life situations, and that just seeing what happens when you put a whole bunch of strangers together and see where they end up and what happens to them all. I think it's a wonderful premise. It's really great.
Thank you. And thanks a million for the opportunity.
Oh, no, it's lovely to chat to you. Where would you recommend people find the book? I think it is out this week. Is that right?
It's actually out tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay. So we're recording on Monday, yeah, the 22nd. So it's out on the 23rd. This episode comes out on Friday, so it'll be out. So you can find it, I'm guessing, in bookshops, online. Is it on audio as well?
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled because this is the first book that will be on audio. So
it's brilliant.
It's on Audible and it's on something else. Is on Kobo or something. But anyway, have a Google and it should come up. Also, the Hachette website is a good place to go, or my Facebook page or Instagram. Yeah.
Okay. And you haven't been hit by the Facebook gremlins?
Listen, that's a ridiculous debacle altogether. It's an awful thing. Yeah, desperate. Well, I'm touching wood, really, because it could be any of us.
Rights for Women page is gone on Facebook, so I'm just in the process of trying to retrieve that, and hopefully they will realise it's not a news broadcasting page as such. So we will see what
happens. Good luck, Pam. Thank you. Because it's such a fabulous site, you know. I'm not pushing myself up here, but I've got a lot of sort of encouragement, really, and tips and just the kind of, that happens to me sort of moment. And the lovely insights into books that you wouldn't get. You know, I think of, like, in particular, Monica McInerney's interview about the Godmothers. I loved that. I haven't read it yet, but I loved that interview. So things like that,
Oh, thanks, Esther. I'm glad that you're getting so much out of it. And, of course, the podcast itself hasn't been affected. It's just the disseminating the information via the Facebook page, you know, but it's on Instagram and the website, of course, is great to have. But thank you. It's good to know that you're getting something out of the podcast. So it's been fabulous to talk to you. Where can people can find you on Facebook? Are you also on Instagram? And where else would they find you?
I'm only on Facebook and Instagram. I find it's probably enough for me anyway.
Yeah. Plenty to manage. Okay. Well, all the best with the book. I hope it just goes flying off the shelves for you. And it's been so lovely to chat.
Thanks a million. Thanks so much, Pam. See ya.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Rights for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Rights for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. And you can connect with me through the website at rightsforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4W Podcast, the Facebook page Rights for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.